Wait a minute. Have you heard the strange and unusual stories of the Forgotten News Podcast?
Hello, everyone. This is Jim.
This is Kit Karen.
We host the Forgotten News Podcast.
On our show, we tell true stories from history, but not the stories you learned in school.
We tell stories that are obscure,
mysterious,
weird,
wild.
For example,
the teenage girl who committed the last stagecoach robbery in the United States in 1899.
The really dumb gang of crooks who unintentionally kidnapped the lieutenant governor of Idaho in 1929.
The group of old ladies in 1893 who would secretly go out at midnight to catch stray cats and then, speed up their journey to heaven.
The farmer who vanished into thin air in front of witnesses, as he simply walked across his empty dirt yard in 1889.
So, on any given episode, our stories might be serious, silly, or sad.
But they will always be a true story.
So now you know pretty much everything about what to expect on the Forgotten News Podcast.
We think you'll like it.
Thank you for listening.
Bye.
I Saw It on Linden Street, the show dedicated to the joy of finding an appreciation in cult films, exploitation oddities, beloved classics, and all points in between. I'm your host, Chris Roberts, inviting you to join us here at the Linden Street Cinema Experience Theater, as we once again dig up a fun cinematic relic from the past. If you're new to the show, thank you so much for joining us. Now, this isn't your standard film review. Rather, it's a synopsis of a film that we feel deserves to have another inspection. Some background thrown in on the actors, information on the director, and hey, if I'm doing my job, perhaps you'll get a half-amusing story out of me. Fair be warned, while we don't cover all aspects of plot, we do discuss endings and spoilers. So, if you'd like to be surprised, please give the film a viewing before you listen to us. If you like us, and I would hope that you do, please recommend this podcast to a friend, subscribe, give us a favorable review. We are wrapping up July. Hey, it's still hot, and we are continuing and finishing this month's theme of Run! That's our selection of some great classic films revolving around the theme of getting the hell out of town. This week, we dive into the surrealist Southern Gothic horror romp that is 1955's cult classic, Night of the Hunter. Join us! So I gotta be honest about this. I've been waiting on this one for a while. I know I said it before, back when we did episode 8 and covered The Friends of Eddie Coyle, but I'm a huge Robert Mitchum fan. I do promise we will do a proper noir episode so I can cover him in, you know, one of my all-time favorite movies and one of the great examples of film noir. That would be the classic film Out of the Past. But hey, for what it's worth, this week's film is an equally worthy endeavor for that actor. Hooded eyes, Roman nose, an all-around good-looking dude with a deep voice. It's as if he was created out of a factory mold that was built to make film noir characters, complete with a fedora and trench coat. He worked hard, he played hard. Indeed, his love of drinking and marijuana was tabloid fodder during the 1950s. And although he was happily married to his wife Dorothy Spence for over 57 years, he chased after women throughout his life with a verve bordering on the obscene. Robert Charles Derman Mitchum was born August 6, 1917, in Bridgeport, Connecticut. Young Bob seemed destined to be a portrayer of antiheroes even from his youth, as he bucked authority at every turn. The only thing I can say I have common with the man, aside from enjoying the films he made, his father was killed at a very young age working in the train yards of North Carolina in 1919, and I can claim my own great-grandfather Thomas was equally killed working in the train yards of Chicago in 1932. After that, whew, Mitchum's childhood was not like most of ours. He got into trouble a lot, getting into fist fights, ditching class. So much so, he was eventually expelled from middle school for openly scuffling with the principal. Can you imagine taking on your principal? He was sent to go to school in New York and to live with his older sister in 1930, but shockingly, he was expelled from high school, and he wound up wandering the country, hopping freight trains and taking odd jobs here and there, seeing all of this great land during the Depression. In 1931, at the age of 14, he was arrested for vagrancy in Savannah, Georgia, and he was put to work on a chain gang. He eventually got out and returned back to family in Delaware, but Mitchum would again spend his time traveling back and forth across the country, making it as far out as California, where now, at the age of 19, he ended up joining a theater troupe in Long Beach, and he worked as a stagehand and a bit player in a variety of productions. By 1940, he had returned back to his family in Delaware long enough to marry his childhood sweetheart, Dorothy Spence, and then he promptly moved right back out to California to get into the world of acting. During World War II, Mitchum worked as a machine operator for Lockheed Aircraft, where he suffered from the dual afflictions of both hearing damage and workplace stress actually caused him to start having visual difficulties. All that will happen before he decided to quit and then pursue acting full time. See, in 1942, he began to appear in uncredited roles, both for westerns and war films, and then in 1944, he managed to land a small role in Mervyn LeRoy's 30 Seconds Over Tokyo. His performance was noted by director LeRoy himself, who then reached out and helped Mitchum secure a contract with RKO Pictures. Now, RKO, at this time, did quality work, no question, but Mitchum, as a new up-and-comer, was slated to star as lead in a lot of lesser-tiered B-movies, pictures that were cranked out for fast cash, which meant Bob was going to be up for some exciting roles in genres that were really more of the same: war pictures, westerns, and the genre that he himself would help define, noir. From 1946 until 1948, Mitchum made 9 films, and out of those, 5 of them were noir films, including one of my all-time favorites, and definitely a future episode here, 1947's Out of the Past, with Kirk Douglas and Jane Greer. He would come in, hit his marks, and was a noted professional on the set. During this time, directors actually liked working with him. When filming ended, Mitchum would drink and party with the best of them, notably being an early adopter and proponent of marijuana. Seriously, Mitchum would walk around Hollywood with a rolled-up joint tucked behind his ear or stuck in his hat band. All in all, things were looking up for the young actor. He was considered a breakout find for RKO. They had transitioned him from the B-movie slate to now being an A-list leading man, and they were promoting the hell out of him. Indeed, Mitchum's good looks, drooping eyes, had won over scores of teenage female fans, who RKO proudly dubbed as being Droolettes, swooning over Mitchum's bad boy image. Bob Mitchum was on top of the world, at least until the night of August 31st, 1948. I don't know how much you know about the LAPD of the 1940s and early 1950s, but if you're a James Ellroy fan or you've ever seen the film LA Confidential, you may have some insight into understanding that the police of the day were only slightly better than the criminals they were attempting to catch. Despite everything Jack Webb would do and try to tell you, the LAPD actually had some very serious image problems, and they wanted examples to be made to combat what they felt was becoming a serious issue of the day: narcotics. Specifically, narcotics from Mexico, the likes of which they believed were being used by very prominent people. Celebrities. Celebrities like Bob Mitchum. They needed a poster boy to kick off their new anti-drug campaign. They needed someone to make an example of, and Bob Mitchum was the perfect pigeon for their plans. Now, truth be told, during the Hollywood studio days, it was rather difficult for police to catch celebrities publicly. Now, don't get me wrong, plenty of celebrities had run-ins with the law. It absolutely happened. Stars and starlets would get arrested for drinking, fistfights, carousing, all sorts of great scandalous and lascivious behavior. Here's the difference. When all of this went down, studio fixers would just show up, pay fines, grease palms, break cameras of photographers, and then sick their retained legal counsel that were kept on hand around the clock to expunge records and take care of things quietly. The LAPD in this situation had to specifically lay a trap that would be designed solely to catch Robert Mitchum. They needed to find him in a position where the Howard Hughes ran RKO could not step in and quickly protect him, or help him quietly sort these sides of affairs out. No, they're going to need an inside man for this. And they actually found one with local LA realtor Robin Ford. Ford himself was at a bit of, you know, legal trouble with the law, and the LAPD decided to use him as a way to get to Robert Mitchum, which was traded in exchange of a lesser sentence. Mitchum was with Ford, touring a neighborhood legitimately looking at some homes to buy, noting they were near a rented home of fellow RKO co-star and friend Lila Leeds, who shared a bungalow in the Hollywood Hills with dancer Vicki Evans. Ford and Mitchum go look at houses that Mitchum was looking to perhaps buy, and then they stopped off at Leeds' home for a visit. They all sat in the living room, talking, visiting, and Mitchum, as was his way, decided to light a joint and was sharing tokes and pleasantries around the room with his friends. About 5 minutes after arriving, a scratching sound was heard at the home's back kitchen door, causing the group to think it was Leeds' two dogs, who were now pawing at the door to be let back in from the yard. Evans walked into the kitchen and opened the back door, only to be blinded by lights and have two police officers run past her with their guns drawn. All four promptly arrested, and as they were being led out through the front of the house, they could see they were surrounded by police, with the press already standing by to take their photos. It was a complete setup. During a press conference held at the LA County Jail, arresting Sergeant A.M. Barr bragged to the LA Times, "We're gonna clean up the dope and the narcotics users out of Hollywood. We don't care who we have to arrest. There's a lot of stuff being used in Hollywood, and we have a good number of important and prominent Hollywood screen personalities all under surveillance. Many of these big shots and stars and other top names do not patronize corner peddlers for fear of a shakedown. However, we now have reason to believe that there's an inside ring right inside of the film industry that are supplying a large number of narcotics users." Mitchum and Leeds were defiant through this entire ordeal, noting this was shameful behavior on the part of the police. They were not running some sort of crazy pot party as reported, nor were they part of any running of a drug narcotics ring. They defined it as it was. It was a police publicity stunt, and they were going to fight it. Evans cried that all of this was a huge mistake, and while she did not argue that it was a setup, she publicly maintained she was just in the wrong place at the wrong time. Mitchum privately worried that all of this would kill his career. At age 31, the young actor was just starting to get a really nice taste of success, but he was no stranger to having run-ins with the law, so he threw his own brand of shade right back at the police, telling reporters, "Look, I've been smoking marijuana for years, I will make no secret about it, and being in jail was like being in Palm Springs, just without the riffraff." Mitchum was found guilty of criminal possession of marijuana and was sentenced to 60 days in jail and then was fined $1,000. Interestingly, Leeds too was sentenced to 60 days, while Evans was not made to serve any time whatsoever and was cleared of all charges by a jury. Ford was equally quietly acquitted of his pot charges that he incurred that night and then was quietly remanded back to LA County for some, quote, unrelated legal disputes. Right. Mitchum ended up serving out his time partially in the LA County Jail, and then later he was transferred to the Wayside Honor Farm out in Castasic, California, where he was put to work as a brickmaker. Popular and likable during his incarceration, Mitchum ended up being voted Mr. Cement Block 1949 by his fellow inmates. Because of his good behavior, his sentence was reduced to 50 days, and upon his release in March of 1949, Mitchum addressed the press, telling them that his stay on the honor farm was an experience that every taxpayer should have to go through. Privately, he was still panicking that he had just sabotaged his career, but the public at large seemed to be inundated with wild stories from gossip rags and tabloids all about Mitchum's debauched antics, real or imagined. And most of them truly were imagined. Thankfully for Mitchum, RKO wasn't going to let their investment in him slip away. You see, Howard Hughes handled it like he handled most of his problems. He threw a ton of money at them. RKO launched their very own hard PR campaign during Mitchum's time in and then after he got out of jail, getting candid shots of the actor out working shirtless, showing him drinking coffee in jail, sitting around with fellow inmates, talking. You know, ordinary run-of-the-mill handsome dude stuff, at least handsome dudes that got arrested. Please, please, girls, go still see his movies. And you know what? It worked. Mitchum would go on to have a hot streak of successful pictures for RKO, which included 1951's His Kind of Woman with Gene Simmons, and then 1952's Macau with Jane Russell. He was a survivor, but, you know, he was also his own worst enemy. Mitchum's partying and drinking were becoming a real problem for the actor and for those he worked with. Things got so bad that he was fired off of the Warner Brothers Cold War thriller Blood Alley in 1953 after they had already started shooting. And the firing came for several reasons, including an altercation he had with the film's transportation manager that ended with Mitchum hurling the man into the San Francisco Bay. He would show up late, still drunk from the previous night of drinking, break furniture in fits of rage. He clashed with director William A. Wellman and would simply walk off the set instead of dealing with him. Wellman would call and complain to John Wayne, whose production company was producing the film at the time, telling him that he just couldn't deal with a man who was, quote, on dope and always walking about 6 inches off the ground. It would be a pretty simple demand. Either get rid of Mitchum or get a new director. Wayne's company, Bat Jack Productions, promptly fired Mitchum, with Wayne himself having to step in to play the lead. He wasn't right for the part. People were starting to be less enamored to work with Robert Mitchum. He shot the Western River of No Return the following year with Marilyn Monroe, and it was a rather rough experience for all involved. Director Otto Preminger was not a fan of Monroe's, and he would clash with the actress on set, while Mitchum would stand quietly off to the side, getting tanked. Later, by the time they were ready, Mitchum was in no condition to actually shoot for the day. Something needed to happen, and that something came in the form of actor-turned-director Charles Laughton. For those of you who aren't cinephiles, Charles Laughton was himself a renowned and respected actor of both stage and screen. He was also an accomplished Broadway director, and he himself was from the golden age of Hollywood. Born in Scarborough, England in 1899, Laughton was a trained Shakespearean actor who began in British films and then in the 1930s transitioned over to roles in Hollywood productions. He's best known for portraying Captain William Bligh in the 1935 adaptation of Mutiny on the Bounty, opposite of Clark Gable as Fletcher Christian. It's a fantastic movie. You should definitely do yourself a favor. Go out and find it. See it. Laughton himself had already directed a number of Broadway plays when his friend and producer Paul Gregory had come to him and told him he had found a great book that, you know, Charles, you just have to read it. 1953's novel Night of the Hunter by author Davis Grubb. Grubb himself was inspired by the subject of the real-life killer Harry Powers, a West Virginian serial killer who himself had lured several widows and subsequently their children to their doom by making use of Lonely Hearts ads in local newspapers during the 1920s. He eventually was caught and executed at Moundsville Prison in West Virginia in 1932. What a perfect subject, right? Laughton loved the book and reached out to contact Grubb personally, thinking that this had the makings of a great film. Grubb and Laughton actually hit it off, and Grubb offered to sketch out some ideas for the film himself. Laughton would go on and direct the feature. Gregory would end up producing. They got United Artists to come in and be the studio to back and distribute the film. All they needed was a script. Grubb was actually Laughton's first choice to adapt his own novel, but the studio wanted somebody who had written a screenplay before. So veteran James Agee, who had just come off of writing The African Queen in 1951, he was brought in to create a script. Unfortunately, that script was 293 pages, and while Agee did cut the script down as requested by Laughton, it would be Laughton himself who would make many, many edits and rework the story so he'd actually be able to shoot it. Laughton and Gregory had to deal with the good people at the production code office, however, as the concept of the film started to get passed around. See, during the days of censorship, it was hard to get the heavily Catholic and very self-righteous moral leanings of Joseph I. Breen, head of the Production Code Office. You can read about him on the LSCEP website in the Blame Canada and Say Thank You rant. We did a whole story on his background there. Yes, he ran that office with an iron fist, and anything that offended his sensibilities or even remotely was viewed by him as being blasphemous, he would go out of his way to censor. So that office really had a problem in dealing with a story that featured a murderous, psychopathic reverend chasing down children. Great lengths were taken on producer Gregory's part to keep insisting, but he's not really a reverend. He's just a criminal who's pretending to be. But in spite of all this, they still got a lot of pushback from the Breen office. Eventually, though, they did let the issue go. The problem is, what the film was about was actually going to come back to hurt the final product later, but we'll get into that as we go on. For casting, Laughton initially thought that the role would be really good for Gary Cooper. But Cooper thought that, hey, if I play this character, it's going to hurt my career. I play decent characters. So he said thanks, but backed out. Charles Laughton reached out to Mitchum and asked him to audition, both because he respected the actor's raw talent and, frankly, because he had felt kind of sorry for Mitchum after the whole 1948 pot bust, and he knew of the actor's spiraling behavior. Lawton saw that Mitchum could be harnessed to play this psychopathic preacher, Harry Powell, a man who cloaked himself in the guise of a pious religious man to hide his true sinister nature. Arthur Grubb was actually concerned that Mitchum was too handsome, too sexy to play the role. But Lawton just looked at him and quipped, "Hey, if you want to sell God, you have to be sexy." When he approached Mitchum to explain about the character, he said, "Bob, I have this main character who's the most dreadful shit." To which Mitchum quickly replied, "Present!" Indeed, Lawton was very happy with his selection, and after the first round of dailies were posted, Lawton and Mitchum sat down to watch them together. Suddenly, Mitchum gets up and pitches himself towards the screening room doors, ran out and into the fresh outside air, discreetly vomiting. Lawton followed him out, asking him, "What's the matter? What's wrong?" And Mitchum looked at him and weakly responded, I didn't know I could be that good." Director Lawton personally chose Shelley Winters for the role of Willa, assessing that she projected an air of vulnerability, something he would have looked for from an actress if he were casting a stage play, you know, the ability to project that feeling out over to the audience. And the actress in this case excels here at being the none-too-bright recent widow. Lawton and Winters had discussed the character, with Winters wanting to play Willa as a fly who's fascinated by a spider, and thus she willingly walks into his web. Lawton loved it and told Winters, "Go ahead, run with that," which gives us this very memorable performance in the process. Now, for the role of the truly pious and kind Rachel Cooper, Lawton sought out silent film actress Lillian Gish on the advice of his wife, actress Elsa Lanchester. After reviewing the actress's work, he completely agreed, and he had to work to convince Gish to actually join him on the set. Billy Chapin and Sally Jane Bruce were cast respectively as John and Pearl Harper, the children who run afoul of the murderous preacher and are forced to take off. The film also features a very young Peter Graves portraying the late Ben Harper, the father of the two children, Willa's outlaw husband. With $600,000 budget and a 36-day shooting schedule, Night of the Hunter started filming on August 15, 1954, and wrapped up as would be expected on time in October, in spite of some on-set issues with Mitchum himself. You see, as one would expect, the actor did have a bit of a problem keeping his demons under control during the production. Although, I have to say, at least as far as Mitchum goes, he tried as best he could to clean up his behavior while he was on set. He thought the world of Lawton, and he truly wanted to please the man who was taking a chance on him. But I stress this, Mitchum's level of best was, you know, not everyone else's definition. Film producer Paul Gregory made it his personal mission to be around and to try to supervise the actor when he could. There were stories of Gregory coming to an agreement with the Beverly Hills police, paying them to alert him every morning when the lights would go on in the Mitchum house, so he could personally follow the star in on his morning commute to work. That way he's not stopping off for an eye-opener, or we can assess if he's actually sober when he arrives at the studio. Of course, as fate would have it, there was a morning that dawned that Mitchum arrived to the set plastered, and Gregory intercepted the star in the parking lot and attempted to persuade him, "Go home, sleep it off, rest. Bob, you don't have to do this. Sincerely, go home. I'll talk with Charles. It'll be fine." Mitchum apparently argued with the producer, and the impasse was finally solved when Mitchum, leaving for the day to return to his home, decided before he would go, he would unzip his fly and christen Gregory's white convertible in a fit of anger. Lawton would later phone Mitchum, understanding the situation, but, you know, in his own avuncular and kind of scolding of the actor, would tell him, "You know, Bob, most people hide their skeletons in the closet, but you yank your skeletons out and you brandish them at folks. You've got to stop brandishing your skeletons, Bob." I could say more about this, but damn, you have been ever so patient in sitting through all of this. So how's about we do this? How about we get to that trailer?
Selling novel that gripped millions.
Oh, wake up! Come on! Oh.
Superb, unforgettable performances by an extraordinary array of talent.
Figured I was gone, huh?
Run, hide in the staircase. Run quick! Ruby, shit! What do you want?
I want them kids.
I'm giving you to the count of three to get out of here, then I'm coming across the kitchen shooting.
The combined powers of Paul Gregory and Charles Laughton brought The King Mutiny Court-Martial to Broadway. Now the screen receives that same creative, electrifying impact. The Night of the Hunter.
You know, keeping up with what's going on in the world can sometimes feel like it's more trouble than it's worth. The news can be scary and make you want to scream. Or there's just simply too much out there to keep up with. But that's why there's the Assorted Goods podcast. It's the amateur's guide to world events, where each episode we take a closer look at a collection of stories that slip through the cracks of the regular news cycle. So find Assorted Goods on whatever podcast app you use, and join me in my attempts to learn a little more about the world, one story at a time.
The Reverend Harry Powell is played by Mitchell, has hit the road again, driving in a stolen car and conversing between himself and the good Lord above, questioning who will be his next victim, who will be the next woman to fall under his spell and allow him to relieve her of both her money and her sinful life. Powell is actually no man of the cloth, but he is nonetheless a pious, switchblade-toting serial killer, who also is a misogynist who despises women and views himself as divine retribution for their general temptation of mankind.
Well, now, what's it to be, Lord? Another widow? How many's it been? 6? 12? I just remember. You say the word, Lord. I'm on my way. You always send me money to go forth and preach your word. A widow with a little wad of bills hid away in a sugar bowl. I am tired. Sometimes I wonder if you really understand. Not that you mind the killings. Your book is full of killings. But there are things you do hate, Lord. Perfume-smelling things, lacy things, things with curly hair.
Unfortunately for Powell, he's arrested as he travels through 1930s West Virginia, stopped because the car he is in has been reported as being stolen. While he's serving out his 30-day sentence at Moundsville Penitentiary, he is put in as the cellmate of the soon-to-be-executed local bank robber Ben Harper, as played by Peter Graves. Powell knows that Harper has hidden the money away and tries to get the man to tell him where he has secured it, but to no avail.
Where, Ben? Where?
And a little child shall lead them.
Now come on, boy. Tell me. Ben, I'm a man of God.
Trying to make me talk about it in my sleep.
No, Ben, no.
What'd I say? What?
You was from the scripture, Ben. You said, and a little child shall lead them.
You killed two men, Ben Harper.
That's right, preacher. I robbed that bank because I got tired of seeing
children roaming the woodlands without food. Children roaming the highways in this year of depression. Children sleeping in old abandoned car bodies and junk heaps.
And I promised myself I'd never see the day when my young'uns would want.
With that $10,000, I could build a tabernacle, make that Wheeling Island tabernacle look like a chicken house.
Would you have free candy for the kids, preacher?
Think of it, Ben. With that cursed, blooded gold.
How come you got that stick knife hid up in your bed blankets, preacher?
The Lord blinded mine enemies when they brought me in this evil place. I smuggled it in right under the noses of them guards. I come not with peace, but with a sword.
You, preacher?
This sword has served me through many an evil time, Ben Harper.
What religion you profess, preacher?
The religion the Almighty and me worked out betwixt us.
I'll bet.
Salvation is a last-minute business, boy.
Keep talking, preacher.
If you used to let that money serve the Lord's purpose, he might feel kindly turned toward you.
Keep talking, preacher.
Now, don't you think the Lord might change his mind if you was to...
Lord, you sure knowed what you was doing when you put me in this very cell at this very time. A man with $10,000 hid somewhere, and a widow in the making.
Harper is executed as expected, without divulging anything. Powell ends up getting released and arrives into the town of Moundsville, trading on his aw-shucks charm and his outward displays of piety. He makes some inquiries and finds out that Harper has left a widow named Willa, who's played by Shelley Winters, and two small children, a 10-year-old John, who's played by Bill Chapman, and a 5-year-old Pearl, who's played by Sally Jane Bruce. He introduces himself and tells the family that he was ministering at the prison when Ben Harper met his end, and he promised the dying man he would look in on them. Willa is completely taken in with the handsome reverend, and both she and her employers at the local candy store, Walter and Icy Spoon, as played by Don Beddow and Evelyn Varden, think he is just the thing needed to help, quote, save the Harper family. Young John is a little more sensible and doesn't trust the smiling preacher who strolls into his life with the words love and hate tattooed across his knuckles.
Ah, little lad, you're staring at my finger. Would you like me to tell you the little story of right hand, left hand? The story of good and evil? H-A-T-E. It was with this left hand that old brother Cain struck the blow that laid his brother low. L-O-V-E. You see, these fingers, dear hearts, these fingers has veins that run straight to the soul of man. The right hand, friends, the hand of love. Now watch and I'll show you the story of life. These fingers, dear hearts, is always a warring and a tugging, one against the other. Now watch them. Old brother left hand hates a fighting, and it looks like love's a goner. But wait a minute. Wait a minute. Hot dog loves a winning. Yes, sirree. It's love that won, and old left hand hate is down for the count.
I never heard it better told.
Powell on a few occasions almost gives himself away, but he quickly deduces that Willa is just too stupid to know where her late husband hid the money. After all, she's both too honest, and even if she wasn't, she would have spent it by now to improve their meager lives. He quickly sizes up that John is the only one around here with the brains, and he quickly begins to question the children about the last time that they saw their father. John and Pearl do actually know where the money is, and before he was dragged off by the authorities, John's father made him swear that he would hide the money and protect the secret, as well as protecting his little sister with his life. That money was going to be the key to saving the family one day. John chides Pearl for almost revealing the secret to Powell, and then Powell focuses in on him. Willa herself is afraid Powell will think that she does know something about the money, making her appear to be some kind of sinner in the man's eyes. Powell instead manipulates that situation, creating a lie that will both placate Willa, while all the while serving as a test to see if John will knowingly lie back to him.
She's mooning about Ben Harper. That wasn't love, that was just flap doodle. Have some fudge lambs. When you've been married to a man 40 years, you know all that don't amount to a hill of beans. I've been married to my Walt that long, and I swear in all that time I just lie there thinking about my canning. John! John! A woman's a fool to marry for that. That's something for a man. The good Lord never meant for a decent woman to want that. Not really want it. It's all just a fake and a pipe dream.
John? Mr. Powell has something to tell you.
Well, John, the night before your father died, he told me what he did with that money. That money's at the bottom of the river, wrapped around a 12-pound cobblestone.
Thank you, Harry. I feel clean now. My whole body's just a quivering with cleanness.
Now confirming that John knows and has lied to him and has made Willa trust him even more, Powell springs his next trap. He proposes to Willa and she agrees to marry him, although he actually finds her rather repellent and he will not consummate their relationship, convincing her that she is sinful for wanting such base needs and telling her she should be grateful now to have a pious man in her life to guide her and her children. When they return back from their elopement, Paul goes right back to questioning the kids, threatening Pearl to tell him when John isn't about, and Willa overhears it all. Thinking he needs to take care of loose ends, Paul ends up murdering Willa in her bed, cutting her throat with his switchblade, and throwing her body into the Ohio River with a stolen car. Her body is found by family friend Bertie Steptoe, as played by James Gleason, and he is so horrified by the sight of Willa's corpse that he ends up drinking himself into a stupor to cope. Powell covers up Willa's disappearance by telling the Spoons that she ran off with the car and left him with the children to pursue a life of sin. And while Walt has some doubts, Icy believes everything that Powell has just told her. He forces the children to reveal where the money is, and realizes that it's been under his nose the entire time. It's hidden in Pearl's doll. John ends up grabbing his sister and makes a run for the river, hopping into his father's boat, and for a time eluding the murderous Powell. But Powell gives chase, following after them on the shore by way of horseback. It's later revealed that Powell killed a farmer to get the animal. His voice rings out in the dark of night, calling after them, driving them to continue to flee. Days of running, John and Pearl end up spending a night on land, hiding in an open barn. John is awakened at first by the sounds of barking dogs, and then he can see from a great distance the sight of Powell on horseback, still following, still singing hymns in the dark, causing John to question if this man will ever sleep.
What?
The children get back to the boat and continue on through the night. They end up falling asleep and waking up against the shoreline with a woman standing over them. Rachel Cooper is played by Lillian Gish. She's a tough, no-nonsense woman who demands that the children follow her up to the house immediately. John is initially mistrustful of her, but sizes her up as an actual caring adult. Cooper, indeed, is caring for other children on her farm, children whose parents are dead or whose parents can't care for them. They wash the Harper children up, give them clean clothes, and feed them. And while they show them stern discipline, there's also love and affection. Soon, the Harper siblings are part of this makeshift family, and they're actually, for the first time, truly happy. That is, until Powell comes to town. He zeroes in on the teenage foundling Ruby, is played by Gloria Castillo, and after he buys her an ice cream sundae and tells her how pretty she is, he ends up learning that John and Pearl are indeed under the care of Miss Cooper on her farm. Powell then inquires about Pearl's doll, and once he knows that it's also there, he leaves Ruby immediately. Ruby returns home knowing something is terribly wrong and confesses to Ms. Cooper that a man bought her a magazine and some ice cream at the drugstore and was asking questions about John and Pearl. Powell does come down to the farm, shedding a bunch of crocodile tears and asking for John and Pearl, but Cooper can read him. And she knows he's lying. When John and Pearl arrive, John tells her flat out, "He ain't my dad," prompting Powell to pull his switchblade and threaten young John and Ms. Cooper to meet that threat with her shotgun. Powell is driven off for the moment, but he yells back he will return later, when it's dark. Powell makes good on his promise, talking at the house from the fence line, trying to intimidate Cooper into giving him the children. Circling just beyond the porch lights, beyond her sight line, and singing hymns in the dark. Miss Cooper is getting tired, but she's vigilant, and yet Ruby comes down, stirred by Powell's singing. The distracted woman is startled by the girl's entrance, and when she resumes watch, Powell is no longer a shadow out at the fence line. He's gone. Cooper wakes all the children and gathers them in the kitchen to keep everybody close in one location. And as they're talking, a noise is heard from the living room. Powell has managed to get into the house. Cooper sends all the children upstairs and warns Powell that she will shoot him if he doesn't leave. Unable to see Powell in the darkness, he himself ends up tripping over a house cat and gives his position away, sneaking up on the woman. Ms. Cooper shoots into the darkness and ends up wounding the Reverend, sending him fleeing out into the barn, where she locks him in and calls the police. The authorities arrive, and they've been looking for Powell. Bertie Steptoe has led them to Willa's body, and as Powell is thrown to the ground and handcuffed, it's all just too much for John. It reminds him about what happened to his actual father. And he begins to sob, and he runs up and begins to beat on the downed Reverend with the doll that he so desired, sending money flying everywhere in front of a now stunned group of officers, screaming that he doesn't want to keep his father's secret anymore. He wants it to be taken back. John then passes out, and he's carried away by Ms. Cooper as the police haul the Reverend off.
Lynch him! Lynch him, Bluebeard!
25
quarters! And he killed every last one of them!
It's the people of Marshall County!
Will you identify the prisoner? Please, little lad, won't you look yonder and tell the court if that is the man that killed your mother?
Back in Moundsville, Powell has been tried for the now several murders he's committed, and John has just finished testifying against him in court. From the gallery, Walt and Icy Spoon scream out that Powell is a modern-day Bluebeard, having been revealed that he's killed over 25 women this way. They incite the crowd to start screaming about lynching him for all the suffering he has caused. Ms. Cooper quickly gets the children out of town as the mob returns back to the jailhouse with axes and torches, trying to storm in and seize the Reverend. The police manage to get the Reverend out, and sent to prison, but the executioner notes that next time he sees Powell, it's going to be a real privilege. John and Pearl are finally free of their nightmare, and they get to have a fresh start, spending a Christmas with the new family who actually cares for them. Credits roll. Geez, where do we even start? Well, let's do this. This actually could dovetail quite nicely into our previous mentions on the rights and agency of children. If we look back to when we covered the little girl who lives down the lane in episode 66, we talked about kids just in general not being taken seriously or listened to. And this entire film, in general, has the overall concept of the adults thinking they are actually protecting children in their own misguided way. You see, children here are explicitly stated as being pure and innocent beings who need the protection and guidance from menacing predation that comes by way of evil adults. You have great examples with both John and Pearl trying to keep a step ahead of the very dangerous Reverend Powell, but even more so, the larger overarching concept included, Miss Cooper is trying to keep her foundling children, and especially the wayward Ruby, from giving in to her adolescent, burgeoning sexuality, and thus fall victim of being a conquest for some of the other young men in town. Ms. Cooper is stern and authoritative, but she's one of the few adults in the film who actually talks and listens to the kids in her care. And listen is just not even good enough. She actually sees and observes John and Pearl. She takes in what they're saying and notes explicitly what they're not saying. John has a great poker face when he's talking to Ms. Cooper. He will tell her the truth. He'll say his parents are dead. But how he's not saying it, what he's implying, is they're running from some trouble. And Cooper picks up on that. John's own wariness of the Reverend Powell from the beginning should set off all the adults who know him and trust him. He's an honest child. He clearly works hard to please his parents, and he is killing himself to honor his deceased father's wishes. If you have a kid like that, and they're coming up saying, this is wrong, this doesn't feel right, wouldn't you, you know, at least give it a slight moment of pause? No, instead, his mother just worries that John doesn't like the Reverend. All of this, though, gets completely shut off and moved to the side by local busybody Icy Spoon. It's Icy who keeps him from interrupting his mother and the Reverend, telling him to come away, and when the young man doesn't want to, she demands complete obedience from him. After all, she's the adult, he's the child. He needs to listen. Honestly, until we hit upon Cooper, all of the adults we see seem to regard children as just things that are around. They're cute, they're innocent, but hey, less is more out of them. It's also telling that in the framing, as Powell is picnicking and leading the town locals in song, they're all belting out a spirited rendition of Bringing in the Sheaves. It's John who's taking all of this in from a distance. The adults of town are not seeing Powell. They're only looking at his outer veneer. It's only John who's actually watching what the man is doing. He's noting how he's being manipulative. And in a world that has so many adults who are behaving so seemingly erratically by the presence of a stranger, John is not only burdened by the horrific promise that he had to make to his father, he is literally troubled by the fact that he is often the smartest person in the room. How about Mitchum? He's fantastic here. His quick ability to shift from being a carnival barking con man to a fire and brimstone preacher. Then, his actual sinister side, how he truly feels about women and any person who would dare to get between him and that lost 10 grand. That is masterful. Likewise, Winters and Gish give fantastic performances opposite of him. One, the perfect willing thrall as part of his diabolical plan, and the other, a stern and actual pious woman who knows a snake oil salesman when she sees one. Aside from Mitchum's general creepiness, the palming of the switchblade, his subtle leering, and his unctuous calls out from the dark, this is a film made all the more horrifying by how Lawton just had it shot.
Children. Children.
As the director, Lawton himself compared the entire story to being a nightmarish sort of Mother Goose tale, and by using black and white film stock instead of color, and taking a page out of German expressionist filmmaking style, he utilized a very surreal and purposely fake setting during the shoot, which actually makes what you're seeing look like a fever dream that our main characters are running through. One shot that comes to mind, the very unsettling scene where John spies Powell from a great distance, where he's looking out across the horizon from the barn loft. It's such a strange and bizarre scene to take in. The barn, hey, that's real. It's built up, it's an actual set that they're in. Midground looks like a stage, however, just with a bunch of fake trees. And then, on a seemingly painted horizon, suddenly you have this odd and rather grotesque-looking silhouette shadow walking across it, with all three pieces coming together to have a very disquieting effect. By the way, that shot itself was accomplished by putting a little person on a miniature horse and then shooting it from a great distance to make the motions feel all the more surreal and alien. As Powell combs the countryside along the river at night, he is not a man as we see Lawton frame him. Instead, he is some otherworldly thing of evil, chasing our children down. So I can hear you asking now, how was this film received? Saying not well is sort of a bit of a misstatement. Not enough people actually saw the film when it was first released to actually have an opinion about it. You see, when Lawton had finished the film, United Artists really had a problem on their hands. Lawton had delivered a very interesting, yet very strange, art film. It was a film that was a genre-bending conundrum. How do you sell this movie to people? Hi folks, would you like to come down and see my Southern Gothic horror film? Oh, don't worry, it's a surrealistic country fable that drifts in and out of film noir, but at its heart, it's also a monster movie, because it features a vicious killer, and it does have content that allows it to be featuring torch-bearing mobs, plus you have elements of a musical here, lots of religious songs, and some slapstick and melodrama thrown in right at the end. And hey, don't forget, we end the film with an old-fashioned maudlin Christmas down on the farm. Hey, wait, where are you going? Don't you like movies? So what does United Artists do? Almost nothing, actually. It was not a regular rollout for a national released film. Instead, you have sort of this weird, small lead-up into having one-off openings. Actually, producer Paul Gregory was hoping what they could do was get some kind of, like, barnstorming roadshow put together where they would take the film on a circuit and promote the fact that they were doing such, but no. Instead, it was a sporadic opening, and hopefully, if you were lucky, it would hit a theater somewhere near you. The film got a sneak peek in producer Paul Gregory's hometown of Des Moines, Iowa. The trailer got broadcast on The Tonight Show in July of 1955. And the film actually then got a premiere date on August 26th for LA. And then again, a month later in New York, it made its debut on September 29th. That was it. As reviews started to come in, ones that you could at least call, quote, good, were not exactly helpful to the viewers. You see, words like curious, unusual, and imaginative were all peppered in the, again, positive reviews. But it spoke to the genre-bending issue that was at the heart of this film. Who doesn't want to see a nightmare-soaked coming-of-age tale about a boy trying to outrun a serial killer on a river with his little sister in tow? Those reviews made no bones about their displeasure, and they didn't pull their punches when it came to saying how much they didn't like the film. Richard L. Coe, writing on behalf of the Washington Post and the Times Herald, stated that the worst villain of this entire lot is director Charles Laughton, whose cheap taste and apparent contempt for simple people has made this film a hideous travesty of the human race. Critic Will Leonard of the Chicago Tribune warned, "Seldom has so much ugliness been put into one movie. Some of it dragged in for no apparent reason." What made it equally as bad? Religious groups. In a move that was actually rather restrained on their part, the Catholic League of Decency publicly posted that they would give this film a grade of B, objecting that it denigrated the concept of marriage with its portrayal of a man who kills Lonely Hearts widows for their money. Still, all that said, the Roman Catholic Diocese of Cheyenne, Wyoming, picketed the film and blocked its actual release from the city. It wasn't just the Catholics. Evangelicals were equally outraged, if not more so. The Protestant Motion Picture Council actively advertised against people seeing the film, warning them that it was an insulting portrayal of Christianity. Lloyd T. Binford, head of the Memphis, Tennessee Censorship Board, banned the film from entering the city, telling the press that this is the rawest film I've ever seen, even though it was later discovered that he had never actually watched the picture. When the film made its way over to Great Britain, it was picketed there as well, and the picture received an adults-only X rating from the British Film Board. Producer Gregory was angry over the way the film was distributed, complaining that United Artists did not have the muscle, the desire, nor the intelligence to handle such a picture, much less promote it. It was deemed in 1955 to be a critical and commercial failure, one that would haunt Laughton and would hurt him so personally. It remained the only film that he would ever direct, causing him to go back to acting and productions and managing stage plays. Out of all the parties involved, in the short run, it was actually Bob Mitchum who would come out ahead. His performance as a villain showed a different dimension to his acting, and it would set him up for new roles in the future that were far more complex and different than what he had previously been cast in. Without Mitchum playing the role of Powell, we never would have gotten the amazing performance we see of having him play Max Cady in the original 1962 Cape Fear. Now, as time went on, of course, opinions about the film understandably changed. Night of the Hunter was a cult film, and as the popularity of television grew in the late 1950s and early 1960s, an entire new generation of children got to see the terrifying film play out with television broadcasts, creating a generation of kids who grew up thinking that Bob Mitchum was really scary. It saw a new cultural rediscovery in the 1970s when Night of the Hunter began to be praised as groundbreaking in both its technique and its surrealistic sensibilities, Throw in the amazing acting, and this is a film that suddenly everyone was agreeing you had to see. By 1992, the United States Library of Congress selected it for preservation among the National Film Registry. It showed up on multiple best-of lists, including 100 Most Beautiful Films, 500 Greatest Films of All Time, making both the BFI and AFI recognition list of films one must see. And at least as of this date, July 2020, it's currently holding a 99% fresh score from critics on Rotten Tomatoes and a 90% fresh score rating with the audience. And to think, all of this from a film that was considered to be a complete bomb. It wormed its way into popular culture as well. Hey, are you a Spike Lee fan out there? Then you should totally note that the character of Radio Raheem, he does his own version of the love and hate speech in Lee's seminal joint, Do the Right Thing, and ended up being shaped by the director's own love of that original film. Now, it has been remade thus far, just once. In 1991, a made-for-TV film starring Richard Chamberlain as Powell, Diana Skewid of Mommy Dearest fame as Willa, Ray McKinnon of Deadwood fame as Ben Harper, and then Reed Binion and Amy Bebaut, respectively playing John and Pearl. Now, aside from a wonderful cameo from the great Burgess Meredith filling in to play Birdie, there is absolutely no point, at least in this man's view, of giving that film a single look. I'm sorry, Richard, you are just no Bob Mitchell. I am horrified, at least as of this date, to share that Universal Pictures in the past few years has actively been trying to get a modern adaptation of this film together, thinking it's ripe for a remake. To them I say, please, please, don't. This film is brilliant, it's wonderful, it's well made. You don't need to have a gritty reimagining of this film. It is this perfect time capsule of a movie, and it needs to be enjoyed just simply for what it is. Besides, it's a good film. You remake bad films. The version of Night of the Hunter screened here at the LSCE is the 2007 MGM DVD release that is honestly a pretty bare-bones edition. It just comes with the film and a trailer. It's also at the moment out of print, but if you so desire, you can still find copies of that version for going around $8. That being said, the good folks over at the Criterion Collection have actually restored this film to its rightful glory, and back in 2010, they released a spectacular edition of the film that comes with some wonderful content, including a making-of film documentary that contains interviews with both archivist Robert Gitt and Leonard Maltin, discussing the contents, plus outtakes from making of the film, audio commentary, clips of the actors on the Ed Sullivan Show, trailers, and conversations recorded with Charles Laughton. Truly, it is something to behold. An embarrassment of riches that can be found on Blu-ray, all could be yours for the low price of $27.97 if you were to go onto Amazon.com today. If that's still too rich for your blood, there's a DVD version of the same from Criteria Collection that comes at $22.97, and again, I would say, well worth it. Now, remember folks, we don't get anything here for telling you where to buy films. We here at the LSCE just think it's important to support physical media, so that these fine companies who own the rights to all of this wonderful content will continue to still release it. And hey, at the end of the day, isn't that what this is all really about? Getting to see the things that you love on the big screen? Besides, when you get down to it, Night of the Hunter is a glorious cult film, and everyone should be exposed to it and see it. So what are you waiting for? Go out, get yourself a copy of the film today. So that's going to wrap things up here for this episode of I Saw It on Linden Street. Thank you so much for joining us. Hopefully you've enjoyed our month of films dedicated to those trying to get the hell out of town and evade pursuit. Next month is going to find us tackling a completely new theme, a strange melange of films that we thought warranted the category of, wait, what? We hope you'll tune in again for that. If you like us, please give us a favorable review, subscribe, let us know. Swing by, check out our website, lscep.com, where we have articles, episode links, and comics for you to peruse. We're also featured on Podchaser. That's a podcast database for listeners and creators alike. Find us there, give us a follow and a review if you could, please. You know, more reviews makes us more searchable, and then we can share with more people. As always, if you'd like to get in touch with us, make a comment, ask a question, send us wonderful things, please email us at lindenstreetcinemaexperience@gmail.com. If you'd like to be even more personal or wish to contribute a segment in the sidecar, please send us an audio message by way of Anchor. That's a free and easy app to use. Until then, I'm actually going to be featured on the Forgotten News podcast, doing a small reading on an upcoming episode. So when that comes out, I will put a link to our website. Go ahead, check that out. It should be fun. So until next time, take care out there. Wash your hands, wear a mask, please stay healthy and safe, and remember, life's too short not to live in the past. Take it easy out there, everybody.